Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast, Naturalization Fraud Edition. I'm your host, Christopher Goffis. On June 22, 2017, the Supreme Court decided Maslenjak v. United States. At the close of the Bosnian Civil War, Divna Maslenjak sought refugee status for herself and her family in the U.S. due to fear of persecution regarding their Serbian identity in modern-day Bosnia and the threat of reprisal against her husband, who she claimed had evaded military conscription in the Bosnian Serb militia. After the family was granted refugee status and Maslenjak became a U.S. citizen, a U.S. court convicted Maslenjak's husband, Ratko, on two counts of falsifying claims regarding Serbian military service on U.S. government documents, since Ratko had in fact served in the Serbian military. When Ratko applied for asylum to avoid deportation, Divna Maslenjak admitted to lying about her husband's military service and was charged with two counts of naturalization fraud. At her trial, jurors were told that a naturalization fraud conviction could be carried out for false claims in Maslenjak's application process, even if the claims did not affect whether she was approved. Convicted on both counts, Divna Maslenjak was stripped of her citizenship. The Sixth Circuit affirmed her conviction. By a vote of 9-0, the Supreme Court vacated the judgment of the Sixth Circuit and remanded the case. In an opinion by Justice Kagan, the court held that 1. The text of 18 U.S.C. section 1425A, which prohibits procuring contrary to law the naturalization of any person, makes clear that, to secure a conviction, the federal government must establish that the defendant's illegal act played a role in her acquisition of citizenship. 2. When the underlying illegality alleged in section 1425A prosecution is a false statement to government officials, a jury must decide whether the false statement so altered the naturalization process as to have influence in award of citizenship. And 3, measured against this analysis, the jury instructions in this case were in error, and the government's assertion that any instructional error was harmless if left for resolution on demand. Justice Kagan's majority opinion was joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Kennedy, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor. Justice Gorsuch filed an opinion concurring in part and concurring in the judgment, in which Justice Thomas joined. Justice Alito filed an opinion concurring in the judgment. And now, to discuss the case, we have Vikrant P. Reddy, who is Senior Research Fellow at the Charles Koch Institute.
So today we're going to talk about Maslenjak versus the United States. And the first thing I should say from the get-go is that I'm not sure whether or not I'm pronouncing Maslenjak correctly. I'm saying the J as a Y. I don't know the languages of the Balkans in Europe, I'm afraid, so maybe it's Maslenjak, maybe it's something a little bit different, but I'm saying Maslenjak. The court decided this case back on June 22nd, and it is basically an immigration case, but what I'm going to do today is talk a bit about the criminal law dimensions of the case, because I think those dimensions are extremely interesting for people who are thinking about the implications of Supreme Court decisions on law and on public policy. And the really important point that I want to communicate to all listeners today is that I view this decision as yet another in a recent line of Supreme Court decisions in which the court seems to be expressing real concern about prosecutorial discretion and overreach. And I think what the court has been trying to do in several recent cases here is look at statutory language and interpret it in a way that reins in prosecutorial discretion. This is another example of that sort of thing. So let's start with the facts. For most of the 20th century, there was a country in southeastern Europe called Yugoslavia, got engulfed in a terrible civil war in the 1990s, and it's broken up into several constituent republics now. There was a woman from Yugoslavia named Divna Maslenjak. She was Serbian, and she lived in the Bosnian part of the country at the time of the civil war. And she sought asylum in the United States. She made the argument when she was talking with U.S. immigration officials that she and her family were really subject to persecution on all sides of this war. They were subject to persecution from the Bosnian side because they were not Bosnian, they were Serbs. And they were subject to persecution on the Serbian side because although they were Serbian, her husband actually was a war deserter. Rather than join the Serbian army to go and fight the Bosnian Muslims, he actually escaped, he deserted, and he lived in hiding for about 5 years. And as you can imagine, this was not viewed kindly by fellow Serbians. Well, the immigration officials accepted the story, and they granted asylum to both her and her husband in 1998. Then in 2004, Ms. Maslenjak applies for naturalization. She actually earns naturalization in 2007. And in her naturalization application, she actually states that she had never in the past given false or misleading information while seeking any kind of immigration benefit. This was not true. This was a lie, because she had lied about her husband when originally seeking asylum. It turns out that he was not, in fact, a war deserter. He did fight in the Serbian army. In fact, he was an officer in the Serbian army. And in fact, for those of you who are familiar with the politics of that region, his unit participated in the very infamous massacre in Srebrenica or Srebrenica. That's another word that I'm not good with pronouncing. The massacre of 8,000 Bosnian Muslims that took place in 1995. When the immigration officials discovered these facts about her husband, they sought to deport him. Ms. Maslenjak tried to prevent that deportation, and in the course of those proceedings, she ended up confessing that she knew about her husband's background and his involvement in this unit. So, in order to gain asylum, and later in order to gain naturalization, she had in fact lied. When the prosecutors discovered this, they sought to revoke her citizenship under a statute, 18 U.S.C. 1425A. 1425A makes it a crime to, quote, knowingly procure, contrary to law, the naturalization of any person. So the key phrase there is contrary to law. The government argued that Maslenjak had acted contrary to law because she lied. And there's a different statute, 18 U.S.C. 1015, which prohibits knowingly making a false statement under oath in a naturalization proceeding. As they saw it, she lied, therefore she violated 1425. That was an act contrary to law. Now, Maslenjak objected to this argument. She said that the lie was not material. The lie needed to be material in order for conviction to be found. Now, this went to the district court, and the interesting thing is that the district court told the jury, I should quote the language here, that conviction would be proper if, quote, the government proved that one of the defendant's statements was false. It said nothing about materiality, and the jury convicted her, and she lost her U.S. citizenship. This then went to the Sixth Circuit. The Sixth Circuit upheld the jury instruction, and so they affirmed the conviction. There is a different holding, though, in the First Circuit. I don't know the details of the First Circuit case, but I do know that the First Circuit ultimately decided that materiality was necessary, that it wasn't enough to just tell the jury a lie is a lie is a lie. You have to demonstrate materiality. And because of this question of whether or not materiality was relevant, the Supreme Court decided it would take the case in order to resolve the circuit split. So like I said, the court came down with their opinion on June 22nd. It was a decision written by Justice Kagan, and it was unanimous. The court decided that the lie did need to be material, and for that reason, the jury instruction was improper. Justice Kagan, as I said, wrote the opinion, and she pretty succinctly captured the holding in the opinion in the first paragraph, and I'm just going to read this statement to you. She wrote that the government must establish that an illegal act by the defendant played some role in her acquisition of citizenship. So, when the illegal act is a false statement, that means demonstrating that the defendant lied about facts that would have mattered to an immigration official, because they would have justified denying her naturalization. The opinion is really well done. I'm of the view that Justice Kagan, whatever I think of her jurisprudence, and I have some questions there, is nevertheless a very good writer. She's very talented, probably the best progressive writer on the court. And she goes through a number of really kind of interesting examples in the course of her opinion. The most prominent one is, she says, let's think about how we use language. Suppose I say to you, John obtained the painting illegally. What do we think that means? When we say John obtained a painting illegally, we probably think that he snuck into the museum and plucked it off the wall, you know, that he did something in the course of getting the painting, not just that was illegal on the way to the museum, that he, you know, ran a red light or something like that, but rather that it really was a part of the procurement of the painting, the illegality. In fact, she said, if I had said something like, John obtained a painting illegally, but that had nothing to do, the illegal act, with the procurement of the painting, it would sound like a nonsense phrase. In fact, she said it would sound like the beginning of a child's riddle. And I think that's probably true. I think all the justices obviously agreed with it. It doesn't really make any sense to use language in that way. That's just not how English is spoken. When the immigration officials were considering the statements that she made in order to acquire citizenship, they were concerned with whether or not she was lying about the facts involved in making the citizenship discussion. When they were trying to evaluate whether or not she had acted contrary to law, they weren't looking at things outside of that scope. So, for example, if she went to the federal building, she was carrying a knife illegally on her, and she filled out the application forms and submitted them, and they were all perfectly truthful, she would have been acting contrary to law in the sense that she was carrying an illegal weapon. But that would obviously have nothing to do with the ultimate citizenship decision. And so for that reason, the court decided that materiality really is central here. A lot of other, I guess I would say, fun examples came up during the oral argument, which made a little bit of news when the case was heard several months ago. The justices had a little bit of fun with this. Chief Justice Roberts said, well, look, there was a time, and the statute of limitations has since passed, but there was a time once when I went 60 in a 55. If I lie about this, is that justification for revoking my citizenship? And Justice Sotomayor asked, is it justification to remove my citizenship if I lie about an unflattering childhood nickname? And Justice Kagan even joked, well, heck, what if I lie about my weight? But all of these examples get to a really serious point, which Justice Kennedy made in oral argument. He said, you know, naturalization is essentially the most sacred right that the United States offers. It seems like if you are going to pull that right away, you would need to be doing it for some kind of very serious reason, not just for some triviality. And so simply saying that the person lied is just not adequate. So the court decided that materiality is necessary, and for that reason, because the jury instruction did not include this note about materiality, it'll have to go back to the district court for that decision to be made. I will tell you on a personal note, I don't have a lot of confidence in Ms. Maslenyak's ability to win on that question. It does seem to me that that's quite material, the fact that her husband had participated in this massacre in Srebrenica. But that's where we're headed now, back to the district court. And we have a more clear law that materiality is necessary. It's important to note, as I said, that what I think is most significant about this case, and what you saw come through in oral argument and what you saw come through in Justice Kagan's opinion, is that they're very concerned that if there wasn't some kind of limiting instruction or some kind of limiting reading into the statute, that you've given extraordinarily broad power to prosecutors to revoke citizenship. You could probably find any number of lies about any number of trivial things. And that's a really, really broad power to hand over to prosecutors. And I think the court was concerned about that. I think they've been concerned about that. It's obviously a major point of national conversation right now. Criminal justice issues are all over the papers and the headlines every single day. And these questions about prosecutorial discretion and prosecutorial abuse have become very significant. They've become significant in a bipartisan way, it's important to note. This case was decided 9-0. There were two concurrences. They were on very technical matters that aren't terribly relevant to the broader point here about prosecutorial discretion. I will note, by the way, that one of the concurrences was written by Justice Gorsuch. We're all very interested in knowing how his decision-making is going to progress. The opinion included a long section in which Justice Kagan tried to, quote, operationalize her decision. All that really means is that she tried to provide some guidance for juries about how they're supposed to assess materiality. And Justice Gorsuch simply said, I don't really know that that's necessary. You know, we made a decision about materiality. I think we got it right, but we should stop at that point. We're not obligated to go any further. Courts need to be a little bit more restrained. And Justice Thomas joined that concurrence. So I thought that was kind of an interesting note about Justice Gorsuch's thinking, which we're all curious about. But again, it's not terribly relevant to this question about materiality and about prosecutorial discretion in cases like this and in all sorts of cases. So that was the case, Maslenjak versus United States. And as I said, I think we can expect more things like this to happen in the future, where the court will look at statutory language and say, well, the government wants us to read this language in an unbelievably broad way. And if we were to do that, we're going to find ourselves giving far too much power to prosecutors. We're going to have to find a way to read this language a little bit more narrowly.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.